number of things about Romans, the 14th chapter, and then certain chapters in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. Along with that, you have to consider the 6th chapter and the 7th chapter. I'm not going to talk about each verse in all of those chapters because we just have 45 minutes. But the passages and the interest in this subject have proven difficult over the years for our brethren to interpret and apply. This was a thorn in the side of those people that we consider the fathers of the Restoration Movement. It certainly isn't an always easy task to separate some of our personal convictions from matters of faith. And I don't know that I can solve that problem for anyone in this lesson. But I do have some things I want to say about the subject that I hope will at least give us a start in this area. I know we have studied this before. Perhaps you know more about it than I do, and you can contribute to it during the questioning period. I want to give a summary of those chapters and how they fit into that particular position in the epistles that Paul wrote. For example, there in Romans, we shouldn't just consider Romans the 14th chapter. In the preceding chapter, in verse 8, he introduced the subject of love. Now, we've been talking about love during this study a great deal. Sometimes in a congregation, I get a little bit suspicious of a brother when he just wants to talk about love all of the time. But there is a scriptural way to talk about love, and there is an unscriptural way to talk about love, and of course, I believe that Paul was scriptural in his application on this subject. In other words, in the 13th chapter, he begins the subject of love, verse 8. Then the 14th chapter begins a practical application of that principle of love. And we need to study it from that particular standpoint. Love is not something you say. It's not something that you stand in the pulpit and talk about. It's something you do in your relationship with your brothers and sisters in Christ. This subject is continued through the 15th chapter, verse 32, in speaking about the treatment of the weak and the strong, their mutual treatment of each other. Then in Romans 16, verses 17 and 18, since Paul was writing the instructions of what to do in these matters that have been brought up, he tells what to do if brethren will not obey his instructions. That was to mark and avoid those. That includes the strong and their desire to maintain their rights at all costs to a person's conscience. Or it includes that weak one who wants to maintain his scruple in an indifferent thing to the point of division. Then in 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, verse 12, Paul introduces our subject by speaking about that which is lawful. All things are lawful, but all things are not expedient. Thou wilt not be brought under the power of any. Now from that point on, he begins speaking about a number of subjects, and we need to determine what is lawful and what is not lawful. Because right there in the 6th chapter, those people at Corinth were mixing something that was lawful, as Ronnie pointed out, with something that was unlawful. In other words, they were saying we can eat meat. Meat for the belly and the belly for meat. And so therefore, we can commit fornication because The body, of course, has this particular function, and this is done, as is our custom here in Corinth, and so we can do that also. But they had mixed something that was lawful, the eating of meats, with something that was unlawful, because God did regulate the sexual activities of his children. Now, in chapter 7, verse 1, he begins discussing those things that they had written unto him. In 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, in those 13 verses, he speaks about the rights or the liberty concerning things offered to idols. Now, in the 9th chapter, we have Paul taking the principles that he has established from 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, right on down through 1 Corinthians 8, and applying them to his own life. And thus, in the 9th chapter, we can see how Paul applied the principles that he developed in those places. Then, in the 10th chapter, we have Paul showing how the children of Israel were in Egyptian bondage. They were baptized under Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and they were released, or they had their liberty from Egypt, from that bondage that they were in. Now, you see, these people were talking about liberty. Well, the Israelites, they were free from a bondage back there, and they had liberty after they crossed the Red Sea. But Paul is pointing out that along with this liberty comes responsibility. In other words, when you have rights, you always have responsibility. They had a liberty here, and they had a responsibility so far as that liberty was concerned, but they didn't take care of their responsibilities, and they failed there in the wilderness. They didn't handle their liberty correctly. And he is saying to them, this is the same situation you people can get yourself into if you don't watch out. Then he gives a lesson about the Lord's Supper, showing how we have communion in with each other and with the Lord in that sacred feast. And he gives an example from the Old Testament, showing that those who partook of the altar had fellowship with the altar. And then he brings to a conclusion his thoughts about eating those things that were sacrificed unto idols. Now, this lesson goes right on through the 11th chapter, verse 1, where Paul says, be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Now, that's not referring to the things he's about to say in the 11th chapter. It points backwards to those things that he has said in the previous chapter, and his application of those things, and, of course, the way Jesus Christ conducted himself in matters like this. So Paul becomes our example in seeing how these things are applied. First of all, let's attempt to identify the weak and the strong in Romans, the 14th chapter, and in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. Now, of course, the grand division was Jew and Gentile. You had both of those. So, when they came into the church, you had two classes of people that had been very different from each other so far as culture was concerned. And I'll draw a little square down here, a rectangle, that will represent the church. And from these two groups of people, we have some coming in from the Gentiles, some coming into the Lord's body, and this central section we're going to designate the strong Jew and Gentile. Because the church certainly had some of each one of those, each one of these in it. Now, of course, from among the Jews there came some that we're going to have to designate as weak Jews. Now, they were called weak Jews simply because they still, even though they had come into the large church, they still had an attachment back here to the things in that religion wherein they had been reared. They still wanted to have those things along with them, and those things back there, of course, did something to their conscience. They had not learned that they were no longer necessary. The same is true over here. This Gentile had a religion. It was a pagan religion, and it had all of the counterparts nearly to the Jewish religion over here. And some of these Gentiles came in as weak Gentiles, and they had such an attachment to those things back there that they could not look upon those in the right way, in the way that God had revealed to them in this new religion that they entered into. Now, the whole idea, I believe it was Jimmy that pointed this out, the whole idea of Romans the 14th chapter, 1 Corinthians the 8th chapter, and those other chapters was for the strong to take the weak and bring them over into this strong area. There in 1 Corinthians 3, he speaks about those babes. He could only speak to them or write to them as babes. They were weak. They were not mature. They were not full grown. But it was up to these strong ones over here to take these weak ones by the hand and integrate them into the large church and get rid of these attachments that they had to their former religion that caused them to be classed as weak. Now, you see, when Paul used the word weak, that meant that he thought those things were not right and that they needed to be brought out of him. And that was the whole goal of his writing these things to them. So, I want you to understand as I begin this message today, that there is no room in any of these chapters for anyone who might be classed as weak today to stay weak. That is not their desire. And you cannot hide behind that cloak in the large church. And if a person refuses to progress from weakness to strength, then another approach is going to have to be used on that particular individual by the strong. I think that there is a built-in tolerance here. There is something that is used here that we can build up the church by. And that was the whole idea of the treatment of the strong toward the weak. And that was to edify them and bring glory to the name of the Lord. The emphasis here in Romans the 14th chapter was on the relationship with the law of Moses. The emphasis on that. But also the Gentiles were under consideration. There could be weak ones in both of those so far as that part is concerned. Now in 1 Corinthians the 8th chapter, there is more emphasis placed on the relationship the Gentiles had with that old pagan religion that they had come out of and those things that were sacrificed unto idols. Now, those weak ones were the ones that lacked proper knowledge about idols and the sacrifices to it. Perhaps some of the Jews could be placed under this category also. And the strong was those who knew that an idol was nothing and had no scruples about eating meat that was sold in the markets. Now, let's take a look at some of the infirmities that they had so far as attachments back to their old religion was concerned. Of course, in Romans the 14th chapter, verses 5 and 6, we have the days mentioned. We know that, among other things, this was one of their problems. This was also brought up in Galatians, the 4th chapter, verses 10 and 11. And we might want to limit this in Romans 14 to the Jewish holy days. They're listed in Galatians, the 4th chapter, as days, which would refer to the daily sacrifices and the Sabbaths, the months, the new moon observances, times, the yearly festivals, and the years, the sabbatical years and jubilees. We cannot forget that the Gentiles had their holy days. They had their yearly feast, and they had their sacrifices that were offered in their religion as well as did the law of Moses. Now, under the law of Moses, certain meats were considered unclean. In 1 Timothy, the 4th chapter, verses 3 through 5, we have the idea presented to us that now then, these things were created to be received with thanksgiving. This was the new law. This was what was law. This is what made eating meat law. Now, there were meats also that were offered to idols among the Gentiles. You remember in Acts the 15th chapter, verses 28 and 29, at that gathering there in Jerusalem, one of their decisions, according to Acts 15, 28 and 29, was that the Gentiles was not to eat meat offered to idols. Now, as I understand that idolatrous sacrifice, it had several parts to it. Number one, there was a part that was actually offered to the idol, and perhaps a part of that was given to the priest. Now, secondly, there was a part that was given to the offerer, the one who brought that animal in. Now then, that person who offered that sacrifice could either have a feast with this, perhaps in the temple, or in his own private home, or he could take it down to the shambles or to the market and sell that meat. Now, there was no question about whether or not it was wrong to eat the actual meat that was offered there in the sacrifice. The question that arose concerning the eating of meats was this right here. That which a man had at his feast, probably in his private residence, because I don't believe, as some have suggested, that Paul okayed a Christian going into an idol temple and eating meat there that had been sacrificed to an idol. The identity of that meat, its relationship with that idol, would have been so strong that it would have been condemned by Paul and later on seems to have been. So, it was all right then for the Christian to eat this meat that had been sold in the markets, or if other situations that we'll notice later on prevailed. Now, Horns makes this statement concerning the Jewish position on these meats. Meats of this description, that is, meats offered to idols, was an abomination to the Jews, who held that not only those who partook of such entertainments, but also those who purchased such meats in the market, subjected themselves to the pollutions of idolatry. The Apostle James therefore recommends that the Gentile Christians should abstain from all meats of this kind out of respect to this prejudice of Jewish Christians. Then, of course, thirdly, the infirmity that is mentioned here that in Romans was the drinking of wine. Now, I may be wrong about this. I am willing to be corrected if I am. But since all of the context shows these things to have a relationship either with this Jewish religion or with the Gentile pagan religion, that this drinking of wine that is used, misused, and abused from time to time refers to the drink offerings, especially those drink offerings that were offered in those idolatrous sacrifices. And if you want to read about them, you can turn to Deuteronomy, the 32nd chapter, verses 37 and 38, where our the Holy Spirit has them mentioned at that particular time. Now, those were some of the things. In other words, the observances of the days, the meats, and the drinking of wine that is listed as infirmities are weaknesses of the weak in these particular passages. Now, there are others that we shall speak of in just a moment. But let's identify the persons to whom these principles that are given here would be applied. Who did Paul apply them to? Well, you know, over in 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, after showing a practical application of his own, he said, "Unto the Jew, I became a Jew." Now, I understand this to mean a national Jew, or so far as the civil part of the government was concerned. They had operated under what we call a theocracy. The civil laws and the religious laws were together. And so when he used this Jew in contrast to those that were under the law, I don't know what he meant, except he was meaning this was a Jew in the national or civil sense. And then he says, to those that were under the law, I became as one who is under the law. Well, of course, this referred to those who were zealous of the law. Were zealous of the law. And they really wanted to bring these things, like circumcision and a whole bunch of other things that could be brought out here, into the Lord's church. Paul says, I became like them. And then he says, those that are without law. You understand that to mean the Gentile people over here on this side of the picture. And then to the weak became I weak. This refers to the members of the church who were weak, in a weakened condition so far as their complete release and separation from these things was concerned. So that talks about the members of the church. In fact, over a little farther on in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, he brings this down, verse 32, to three classifications: the Jews, the Gentiles, and the church of God. So those are the people that he would apply these particular principles to. Now, as I understand these scriptures, not only did the strong have obligations, but the weak had obligations as well. And sometimes we major on speaking about the strong and forgetting about the obligations of the weak. And this has caused some much trouble in the Lord's church, because the weak act as if they have no obligations whatsoever. And as one commentator said, the weak Christian is the biggest bully that the church has in. And they can actually rule and overrun strong brethren who are willing to give in to them because of the strong brother's strength. But we cannot, forget about the duties that the weak have. In Romans 14, verse 3, the weak is forbidden to judge the strong. So if we're going to appeal to these scriptures for a particular right that we believe we have, we need to be ready to accept the responsibility. This word judge means to condemn. In other words, it would be wrong for the weak to condemn the strong in these matters. And then in verse 5, we understand that he too must be fully persuaded in his own mind. Now remember, Paul is writing these epistles in order to tell them what to do in these situations. Now, what if they wouldn't accept him? What if they would not learn from them? What if they would not take these principles and apply them to themselves? Well, Paul says, you want to be fully persuaded in your own mind. In verse 14, I believe it is, Paul said, I know and am persuaded of the Lord. You see, what Paul was writing was what the Lord had revealed to him about these matters. And so they were not going to have much choice in the matter as to whether they could accept these principles or reject them. It was not optional with them. But that strong brother was to understand the weakened condition of these people and get them into a situation where they could instruct them and bring them to this point of strength. In chapter 15, verse 2, the subject of edifying that brother is brought up. And that has to be the object of the strong Christian. Furthermore, in verse 19, that weak brother is obligated to follow after the things that make for peace. If he doesn't do it, then he's not following the principles that have been laid down here by the Lord through Paul. Now, the strong, of course, had more responsibilities. Because you see, that strong one had the ability and had the talent and had the strength to condescend to that one who was just a baby. Like a father or mother would take care of a child down here who was just born and who was coming up in the family. And so he said in chapter 14 and verse 1, him that is weak in the faith, receive. Now let's take a look at that word receive. What does it mean? Well, it has in it the idea of taking that person in so far as hospitality is concerned and so far as showing a special interest to that person is concerned. Over in 1 Thessalonians, the 5th chapter, we're told support the weak. That word support comes from a word, if I remember correctly, that means stick to them, stick with them. The illustration is given of adhesive tape sticking on your skin. And that's how the strong brother is to treat that weak brother. Stick with him. Receive him into your fellowships. Now, I'm talking about receiving him into the church because it says the Lord God has already received him. But this strong brother here is to take this weak one and stick with him, accept him into his hospitality, not for the object of disputing about those doubts that he has in his mind, those things that he's not fully convinced about yet, but of course for the purpose of bringing him to this point of strength through edification in a wise way that perhaps I don't understand all of the ways or perhaps the best way to do this, but at any rate, they were to receive him in that particular way. And this subject of reception of that weak brother by the strong is brought up and continued till right on over into the 15th chapter, where it speaks about verse 7, "Wherefore receive ye one another, as Christ also received us to the glory of God." That's the subject that has been under consideration. This is that practical application that we are talking about. Now, not only must he receive them in that way, he must not despise them. He must not despise the weak. This word despise means to make utterly nothing. This strong Christian over here cannot look at the weak. This one over here cannot look at that weak one in such a way as to make that person a non-entity so far as the church is concerned. You see, that would be the opposite of this reception of that strong one. And of course, that strong one must be fully persuaded in his own mind. He cannot condemn the weak. Verse 13, he must act in such a way that his good cannot be evil spoken of. In verse 16, whenever he ate meat, he had to eat it in such a way that it would cause no offense. And of course, he had to keep his faith to himself and God. Verse 22. And he could not let anything become a stumbling block to the weak, according to 1 Corinthians 8 chapter and verse 9. He had to please his neighbor, that weak one, to his good, to edification. And in this way, the weak would not be remain weak, but rather would be lifted to that point of strength. Now, I want to say something about law here at this particular place, because we are told in two places in our text that all things are lawful unto thee. Now, I'll tell you, I have been in places where they have taken this verse and they says, you know, it's all right for us to go out here and get drunk. It's all right for us to drink beer. It's all right for us to go out here and commit fornication. It's all right for us to do this, and it's all right for us to do that. Because it says, all things are lawful unto me. Now, brother, a thing is not lawful unless you can find it in the New Testament. We've got to understand that when we're studying this particular subject. And if any of you brethren are here that don't believe we're under law today, you need to take another look at these passages. Now, that doesn't mean that you can just go out here and pick up something and say, now, this is lawful unto me, because I think it's all right. You're not a law unto your own self. Our faith still must come from the Word of God, and that's the reason Paul is writing the Roman epistle and this epistle to the church at Corinth in this particular matter. And I want you to notice how closely Paul follows this idea of lawfulness in his own personal application of these principles. He says in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, verse 33, that he's going to please all men in all things. Romans 14, 21, that, just anything. So I suppose that it is obvious that Paul intended the list of indifferent things to be expanded from what he listed in those places. But all of them have to be lawful so far as our acceptance and so far as our growth toward is concerned. Now, in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, verse 13, Paul lays down the principle that was to govern their actions. 1 Corinthians 9, we have Paul using two things from his own personal life to show that how he applied. Number one, Paul was unmarried. see, he'd been talking about this before, but he was unmarried. Furthermore, he took no pay from the church at Carville. Now, the reason he did, the reason he did not accept that pay was simply because he was applying this same principle that he had over here, that he has given to these people so far as their treatment of the weak is concerned. In other words, when he said, I did not take anything from you, it was his right to take money from them and support at Carving. That was his right, because the Lord had ordained that those who preach the gospel should live of the gospel. Now that right was lawful, wasn't it? But now he says, all things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. In other words, it wasn't expedient for him to take that pay from the church at Corinth. He did have some support from time to time, but he was willing to give up that right in order to gain more souls. And you can read about that in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 12. And those verses that follow after that. Why, he said, have we not the right? See, have we not the right to lead about a wife, a sister, like the other apostles are doing? Well, of course it was scriptural. It was lawful. It was right for them to get married. But it was not expedient to. Now, that's what Edwin's talk was about. You see, it was right for those people to get married. But there were certain times it would not have been expedient for them to get married. They had the right to. But then it might not be expedient for them, might not be profitable for them to do that particular thing. So, we have that as being two of the ways Paul applied these. Now, 1 Corinthians 10th chapter, he begins dealing with the idolatrous part of our subject. You know, in the 8th chapter, he said, you know, you don't know things as you ought to know them. They had written to him and evidently said, we know that an idol is nothing. And therefore, we can go into that idol temple and eat of it. And incidentally, they believed that also they could go into that idol temple and commit fornication. They were discussing today whether about the church at Corinth and their ideas about this. I want you to listen to 2 Corinthians 12 chapter verse 21. He said, and lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and that I shall bewail many which have sinned already and not repented of their uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed. Now in that idolatrous worship, there was not only the eating of the meat sacrificed to idols, fornication was a part of that worship of those idols as well. And they thought they could go in there and do that as well. And I thought that was a good point that Edward made about, Ronnie made, about how that when they were joined together, then they became as low. And if it was in that idol temple precinct, they became just as idolatrous as that woman, because that was the way that they worshiped. There was a union involved there. And so he gives the Lord's Supper there, first of all, to show them how that we have fellowship one with another and with Jesus Christ because we eat of that bread and drink of that cup. Do you think there's any difference if you eat and drink in that temple and eat those things sacrificed to idols? No, there would be no difference whatsoever in that. You are having communion and you're having fellowship with that particular idol. Now, And he had told them, you don't know everything as you ought to know it. First of all, they didn't have love with that knowledge. And I don't have time to really go into that. I would like to. But you can have knowledge, the truth about something, and not have love with it, not speak the truth in love. You can do an awful lot of damage. But I want to tell you, you can have love and not have the truth and do a lot of damage too. Don't ever forget that. But the two go together. They are two things that are essential to each other. But there was another element missing so far as their knowledge was concerned. All the truth hadn't been revealed on that subject. And so Paul gets ready to reveal some more truth on this subject to them regarding eating the things offered to idols. He said, don't you know that those Gentiles who offer those things unto the idols, they're offering them to demons, they're offering them to devils? Well, you know, they said, an idol is nothing. Paul said, you don't know that like you're supposed to know it. You haven't got all of the knowledge yet. The demons are the host there in those feasts. They are the ones that they're offering them to. And I don't want you to have fellowship with devils. You can't drink the cup of the Lord, and you cannot drink the cup of the devils. Why? Because when you do, you have fellowship with those devils, with those demons. When the plural word devil is used, it means demons. So, they hadn't thought about that. You know, that's what we have to watch out for today. Putting ourselves into a position where we are fellowshipping sin. Where we're fellowshipping something that is wrong through our participation in it. I'm not sure that I can apply all of these principles to every situation that would come up. But that's one of the things that we have to watch out for. That's the reason why Paul would not permit them to eat that feast, there in the temple itself. Now, I know that in one of the verses it says, if a man see you, eat at meat in that temple. Paul did not okay that practice there. He just said that you're going to cause offense to one of these brethren. Here in the 10th chapter, he forbids such a thing because there would be no doubt about whether that meat had been offered to idols or not if they were eating it right there in the temple where the sacrifice was brought in there, offered on that sacrifice, and then prepared in a feast. Well, later on, in Acts the 16th chapter, verse 3, Paul had Timothy circumcised. Some of those people didn't want to turn loose of circumcision. But he had Timothy circumcised. Circumcision was placed in this area of indifference. And so, there in AD 53, Timothy was circumcised. Then, in Acts the 21st chapter, verses 20 through 26, we find Paul doing a strange thing. And I don't know how many questions might be asked about that. I don't know whether I can answer all of them or not, if they are asked. But Paul was charged by those church leaders there in Jerusalem to pay for the vows of others to conciliate the Jews. This was in AD 58 and 60. Now, so far as the length of time, we need to identify the conditions set forth to regulate the length of time a person could remain weak and not be considered rebellious. Because there's a point when they wouldn't give up these things that they had come out of and separate themselves from it, that they would be rebellious. So Romans and 1 Corinthians were written to give answer as to what the Lord required regarding the old law and those pagan practices. The weak could not just ignore these instructions and continue in their condition. And while they were in the process of being fully persuaded, the stronger brethren, who already had this knowledge, were not to give offense to the weak. Now, when the word stumbling block was used, it indicated that weak one was making progress in this direction. But somebody put a stumbling block there in front of him and caused him to fall down or stop making progress in that particular area. So we would have to watch out for that. There's two words used in these scriptures talking about stumbling block. One of them means a snag. One of them means something that a person would just stumble over like a stone in a trail. But the other one is a snare that was deliberately set. So he has in mind two things that would give a person offense. And that is something that you might deliberately do, and then something that might be accidentally done, such as a stone being there in that place that we are responsible for. But if they stubbornly refuse to make progress, giving in to their scruples was to stop. Now, this is not a lifetime job, so far as I can tell. Titus was not circumcised when Paul took him to Jerusalem. Galatians 2, verses 3 and 4. This was in AD 51 and 53, very early in all of this. The conduct of Peter, James, and Barnabas was not tolerated in Galatians, the second chapter, verses 11 through 14. He said in Galatians 4, verses 11 and 12, ye are observed days. I am afraid of you over there. In Romans, he says, you observe days to the Lord, that's fine. But now then, here in Galatians 4, he said, I'm afraid of you for doing it. Why? Because they had gotten into a position where now they were rebellious and factious and not learning those things and actually rejecting the things that had been given to them. And Romans 16, verse 17 seems to be the final end of those who were classed as the weak but would not grow in the right direction. And of course this is applied to the weak and the strong because it speaks of those who give offense. That's what he's been speaking about. And it also speaks of those who bring in another doctrine. They are to be marked and avoided. So I don't see this as an ongoing relationship in the church with the same individual year after year after year. But we do have a responsibility here.